the program. We'll take some questions for our two panelists. Then we're going to take our break a few minutes early, and then we're going to come back with Alain and David Katz. And Alain, that will give us a chance to fix that technical issue, and we'll just resume from there. So questions for our panelists or further discussion? Or coffee? Correct.
A question to both of you. To what extent this very fascinating biological diversity that we have in food experience and so on, how far are we of getting this mainstream in terms of having a finer grain approach to policy or to product design or whatever? What are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Actually, I'm glad you asked that, because one thing I forgot to mention is that one of the things that we're interested in knowing is whether or not providing individuals with their genetic profile, whether or not that influences their behaviors. And we recently obtained a grant earlier this year to test that hypothesis. The only information out there in the literature in terms of genetic testing and behavior is for testing for disease genes like BRCA1 and cystic fibrosis and that sort of thing. But these are not disease genes. These are modifier genes, genes that affect relative risk. And we are interested in knowing whether or not providing that information can influence their behaviors more so than not.
That's a great question, and I'd like to open it up, actually, to discussion, because the way I look at psychiatric genetics, for example, and it really applies, though, I think, to a lot of medical genetics, is we've sort of had 10 or 15 years of being able to just fool around and get some initial data and understand what we're looking at. But now, of course, there's tremendous pressure and demand to translate this into changes in people's lives, which is very reasonable. And I can say, though, that writing grants and trying to do this in a grant, it's very challenging, because there's so much complexity when you look at genetics. There's so much variability among different populations and different environments. And I'd be very interested in hearing what you think would be needed to sort of translate this into something that would be enough for policy. You know, as a scientist, my caution is that we have to replicate these findings over and over again, multiple times, in thousands and thousands of patients and samples, really, before I would feel comfortable, you know, going to policy. But maybe that's too conservative. So I'd be interested in hearing other people's view of that. How strong a genetic effect would you need to see before you'd want to make it policy, I guess, is the question.
Phil James from London, the cynic. I think this is absolutely fascinating. And that presupposes the obsession with individualistic approaches, which Lorette and I have debated for several years. The interesting thing came in a chance remark about East Asians having a lower prevalence of one of these genes. I mean, to what extent? I mean, if you look at Cavalli-Fortz's analysis with this huge group of the extraordinary evolution of mankind, are we seeing distinctive population differences in these genes, which then have potentially very big implications in terms of policy? I mean, frankly, I'm pretty cynical about the issue of individual, except in the clinical context. But I mean, in terms of population strategies, I very much doubt that that's a coherent approach. But what about this analysis of different population groups? And, you know, is that likely to be sufficient? I mean, if you look at the so-called primitive genes, analogous to the chimpanzees, or was it, of Cavalli-Fortz's, I mean, it's quite a dramatic reduction in the proportion of, in quotes, primitive genes by the time you get to the Aborigines. So have you tracked that at all?
Well, I can give you a very concrete example related to the D4 gene. There is one paper that has demonstrated that in Africa, with the same genetic tribe that lives at a very in a very dry equatorial climate, the subgroup of males who migrate over long distances have a different relationship between the variant that I've described and their fat-free muscle mass compared to those who are staying put and are not migrating. And there's a whole other set of hypotheses related to the gene and migration and the basis for evolution. So there you have a very narrowly defined difference genetically just based on that behavior of migration versus not. So the answer, I think, is definitely yes. And the gene that I have described is also, the variant that I described is also very low in oriental populations. It's only about 2% that would have the 7 repeat, whereas in Caucasians it's about 30%. And then in South American Indians it's about 60%. And the rates of obesity are sort of follow that to some extent as well. So that's the thing, is that we have to look at subpopulations and sometimes very narrowly defined to understand these effects.
Right.
I haven't disagreed with Phil for some time, so I just could not resist the temptation. I think that one point that that type of sophisticated mapping of the biological diversity with respect to food, to preferences, to taste, and so on, this is a major problem of current policy. Ostrom in the domains of not accounting for the diversity of animal, of physical biology called this panacea approach to policy. We think that one size fits all, and when you see the diversity of response to sugar, fat, or whatever, I think that there is significant food for thought. When Phil used to say to me that I'm calling him the grandfather of obesity, and every report he has done, obesity has been increasing. So something goes wrong in the current approach to policy, and I think a bit more understanding of the diversity that is out there may not be bad as food for thought.
One other point I'd like to make in terms of policy and what we're discussing is perhaps where the policy can start with is high-risk families. So rather than looking at the population as a whole, let's look at families where all the girls are developing obesity and eating disorders and binge eating, et cetera, you know, and the ones where we find the gene effects very, very obvious, and intervene there. So look for those high-risk situations. And, I think that, again, is true of all of medicine, probably, as a starting point.
So that final point.
Dave Sparling at the Ivy Business School in Canada. I have a question about the process, because it seems to me we're just starting to scratch the surface in this area. And right now it's taking how long to essentially confirm that a gene is, you know, is an important effect. The range of possibilities is absolutely massive. What would it take to actually accelerate our knowledge exploration here? And just going back to your first point on what do we think, is this going to be a big policy issue? I think in cases where we're looking at 30% of the population, probably. But a lot of the work that's going to happen is going to be on small segments of the population. And there, I think we really need to get into more of the question of how do we inform people about, you know, what this means, and then how do we help them develop strategies for dealing with it. But I'd actually like to go back to how do we actually accelerate this knowledge development process?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, we are just beginning to scratch the surface. And I think if you look at the advances being made in the field of human genomics, we've learned an incredible amount over the past couple of years. We used to think that single nucleotide, single base changes were the most common form of genetic variation. We now know that copy numbers, because they cover a vaster swath of our genome, make up a greater extent of that variation. And so we're just learning a lot more of just fundamental human genetics. What's needed really is, and you know, folks like us and others are just trying to translate that knowledge. So there's, you know, as the acceleration of discovery in from the genomic side is occurring, there's a bit of a gap in terms of translating that to understand it. So I still think we have a lot of busy work to do. And we're also beginning to understand the complexities of the interactions of genes and genetic epistasis, how a gene variant can act very differently in one background than another. A lot of that is really fundamental behavior, and I think even though Francis Collins, 10 or 20 years ago said that, you know, this would be in clinical practice in 10 years, that hasn't come to fruition. So,
if I can just add to that, I mean, one thing we need to be doing, which alludes to our relationship, we only see each other once a year, is that there is a lot of data out there potentially available. There's a lot of many cohorts that have been collected. And what we need to do is collaborate across centers, and that's happening. I can tell you that there's tremendous opportunities to collaborate. And the one nice thing is that it's really easy to genotype, and it's much less expensive than it used to be. So you can look at just about any aspect of the genome relatively cheaply these days. So it is going to speed up very, very rapidly now, and that's good news.
We have one more point before the break.
I was just going to say that there may be a parallel here in the social sciences, that there has been a disconnect between policy scientists or social scientists and policy makers. And we social scientists are looking at statistically significant effects when we're reporting it, and the policy community is interested in effect size. So as scientists, we think we know something about significance and are very hesitant to comment on effect size. And, of course, the policy community doesn't really care at all about statistical significance. They're interested in effect size. So until we get over that, that's sort of befuddled the conversation between the social scientific community and the policy community. And that's probably going to be something until genetic scientists are willing and able to speak more directly to observable effect size as opposed to statistical significance. And I know that may make people uncomfortable and going out beyond what we really think we know as scientists.
Well, I think your point is extraordinarily important, and I can almost guarantee that there aren't any huge effect sizes in genetics, in the basic sort of genetic studies that we're discussing. These are tiny effects, really, you know, relative to other biological effects. And that's part of the problem, is that we're not going to see any huge effect sizes. There's very few human illnesses for which there are large effect sizes, again, for what it's worth.
And just to add to that, I mean, part of the challenge has been the limited collection of environmental data.
Right.
So, as Robert said, it's very cheap to genotype. And one of my colleagues often commented that anyone can genotype, but not everyone can phenotype. And there's very limited data on good phenotypes, whether it's eating behaviors or assessing dietary intake.
That's right. Yeah, that's where the time and cost comes in, is, and refining what we're looking at. That's the critical step forward. Yeah.
So with that, I'd like to thank our panelists. If Alain Daguerre and David Katz could come up to the podium, and the rest of us will take a 15-minute break.